Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
Face masks, these face masks are the most important, powerful public health tool we have. And I will continue to appeal for all Americans, all individuals in our country, to embrace these face coverings. I've said it, if we did it for 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks, we'd bring this pandemic under control. These actually, we have clear scientific evidence, they work, and they are our best defense. I might even go so far as to say that this face mask is more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine.
CDC Director Robert Redfield testifying before Congress yesterday, imploring the public to wear face masks, but someone else was watching. President Trump, who went out of his way to reject what Redfield said at the White House later in the day.
The mask is a mixed bag. There are some people, professionals, Scott, you would know a lot of them, but there are some people that don't like the mask because of the touchiness and the touching, and then you're touching everything else. They feel that masks have problems.
The Scott Trump was referring to is Scott Atlas, his new coronavirus advisor. The president also disputed a vaccine timeline that Dr. Redfield laid out, which we'll talk about in a minute. It's all part of a broad trend of the politicization of the CDC and of public health in general. And we're going to talk about all that, including the bizarre Facebook rant from the former HHS spokesman, Michael Caputo, with Dan Diamond. He covers healthcare politics and policy for Politico. Hi.
Madeline, thanks for having me back. I should hasten to add, Michael Caputo is still technically the spokesperson. He's just on medical leave for the next 2 months.
Oh, okay. So why did he take a medical leave?
He took a medical leave because Mr. Caputo said that he had uncovered something concerning in talking to doctors last week that needed more screening, a lymphatic issue. But this decision to depart the agency for now comes at the same time that Mr. Caputo has been under massive scrutiny for attacking scientists, allowing one of his aides to push on the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, to edit their reports. So Mr. Caputo is stepping away at a time of maximum pressure on his job and his team.
Right. And so he had also issued this Facebook, I guess you could call it a rant. Let's listen to a little bit of that video.
I'm not going anywhere. They're going to have to kill me. And unfortunately, I think that's where this is going. The partisan Democrats, the conjugal media, and the scientists, the deep state scientists, want America sick through November.
Okay, so then he talked about sedition by these scientists, left-wing hit squads plotting an armed insurrection. What's happening there?
I think what's happening, Madeline, is the world is seeing a bit of the Michael Caputo that health reporters have been talking to for the past 5 months, ever since he was installed by President Trump as the spokesperson for the health department. This Facebook Live video was maybe a bit turned up from what he said to reporters privately, but not that much. And previous reports about Mr. Caputo and his behavior at HHS had not gotten very much attention until this past week, when they were paired with new investigations, including some that we did at Politico, about how his team was doing more than just making proclamations about what's going to happen with the election or attacking career scientists, but actually stepping in and trying to change what scientists are saying, whether Dr. Tony Fauci, who was warned by one of Caputo's aides not to talk about the risks of coronavirus to children, or this effort to go in and edit the CDC's morbidity and mortality weekly reports that one of Caputo's aides was very much pushing for.
And Caputo himself said he didn't even read those reports, right?
So I watched the video. We got it on Tuesday, and it was striking. On the one hand, Mr. Caputo defended the effort to edit those reports. He said that his aide, Paul Alexander, was just stepping in to defend the president, and that the scientists were trying to undermine President Trump by burying things in these reports. So he clearly believes that these reports have damaging information that is intended to hurt President Trump and his reelection bid. But then in nearly the same breath, Michael Caputo said, yeah, I've never even read one of these reports, so how could I edit them? Which didn't quite square with the ongoing effort from his team. I should also add, Madeline, we have no evidence that there's anything buried in these CDC reports that is intentionally trying to hurt the president. These are long-running scientific bulletins that are intended to inform people about the evolution of the virus.
Yeah. Okay. So what is happening with all of this, with the CDC and with the information being contradicted by the White House? Is the point to do what exactly? To undermine the information? I guess I'm a little confused as to why not everyone is on the same page if it's all part of the same executive functioning of the government.
I think you're right to be confused, because we have different messages from the administration in the middle of this once-in-a-century pandemic. There is the message from scientists like Dr. Redfield, who testified in front of Congress on Wednesday and said that vaccines are not something that we should bank our entire response on. There's a good chance that they might not be incredibly effective. We probably won't have enough doses to protect all Americans until partway through next year. The White House and President Trump specifically have pinned a lot of hope on vaccine development, and that a vaccine will arrive to end this pandemic that has separated so many of us from loved ones, changed our economy. The president has constantly hoped for some magic pill, whether it was the vaccine, hydroxychloroquine, something else to turn around the coronavirus crisis. And it just doesn't work that way. So that's where the breakdown comes between the scientists, who are issuing at times dire reports, and a White House and President Trump's allies like Mr. Caputo, who are convinced that the scientists are just being pessimistic on purpose to undermine the president.
Well, here's Dr. Redfield yesterday talking about when we can reasonably expect a vaccine.
If you're asking me when is it going to be generally available to the American public so we can begin to take advantage of vaccine to get back to our regular life, I think we're probably looking at late second quarter, third quarter 2021.
Okay, so that's in about a year from now, correct?
That's my math too.
Right. And so then here's Trump's response.
I called him and he didn't tell me that. And I think he got the message, maybe confused. Maybe it was stated incorrectly. No, we're ready to go immediately as the vaccine is announced. And it could be announced in October, could be announced a little bit after October. But once we go, we're ready.
So that's about a month from now, doing the math, doing the easy math. So who should the public believe?
I would go with the career scientist and virologist like Dr. Redfield, who he's a Trump appointee. He's a political figure, but he and his agency are the ones with the track record here. President Trump has spent 3.5 years as president promising that a health plan was just around the corner, a health plan to replace Obamacare. At times he said it's 2 weeks away. Well, those 2 weeks were 2 years ago at this point. The idea that a vaccine might be arriving in a month, it is possible. There are some vaccines that are moving along fairly quickly, not just in the United States, but around the world, that could be administered under emergency authorization at the end of October or November to perhaps frontline workers or people who are at high risk. But the idea that all of us will be vaccinated, all of us in America, the logistics behind that, Madeline, it just can't be done until we know what the vaccine even looks like, how many shots we'll need, which company came up with the right one. We're not there yet. And to do all of that in the next couple of weeks, it beggars belief as fast as everyone is trying to move to solve this crisis.
Dan, thank you so much.
Madeline, thanks for having me.
Dan Diamond from Politico. Well, let's talk more about when a vaccine can be reasonably expected with Katie Thomas. She covers healthcare and the drug industry for the New York Times. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So the three major drug manufacturers who are in the late stage trials, AstraZeneca, Pfizer, and Moderna, all say that they can have a vaccine by the end of the year. Is that likely?
It's possible. It's a possibility. you know, in the world of vaccine development, you know, nothing is certain, and lots of things can happen that can change the timeline. So those estimates are really kind of the best case scenario. If everything goes right, that's when they could have it.
All right. And as you say, there can be hiccups and some major hiccups. And we saw that with AstraZeneca, which had to suspend the clinical trials after someone got sick. What has been the status of that and how concerning is that?
Beginning September 6th, so over a week now, they halted all their trials around the world because they had reports that a participant in their trial in the United Kingdom had developed serious neurological symptoms. We have reported that those symptoms were consistent with something called transverse myelitis, which can be fairly serious. But the company hasn't said a whole lot about that. They declined to release details about this person because it's their sensitive medical details. You know, they've not really said whether it's been determined to be related to the vaccine or not. In the United Kingdom, the trials did resume. So an outside panel of experts decided that it was safe to resume the trial. And in Brazil, the trial there has resumed as well, but it has not yet restarted in the United States. And so that's a perfect example of something that, you know, it could turn out that it's completely unrelated. It's very typical and normal for, and one would hope expected, you know, for a company to want to halt a trial when somebody develops a serious condition. Doesn't necessarily have to be related to the vaccine. People do get sick for many different reasons, but they're checking it out, and the time that they're taking to check it out could push that date back. And that's just one mm-hmm. example of the types of things that can happen that can make predicting exactly when a vaccine will be available very difficult.
Yeah. And so let's say there is a vaccine or a couple vaccines approved by the end of the year, let's just say, then what happens? Like, who's going to get it first? How will it be rolled out?
So the first period, the first couple of months will be what the federal officials have described as kind of a constrained period. There will be millions of doses available, but not enough to vaccinate widely or the whole U.S. population. And the precise details of who would get it first are still being worked out, but generally groups such as healthcare workers, the elderly, essential workers, like people who are police officers or others, would be at the first front of the line. And then another complicating factor is that at least for these first front-runner vaccine candidates, all of them require two doses. So you take the total number of available doses and you divide it by two if you want to try and figure out how many Americans could get vaccinated.
And we know for sure it'll take two doses?
As of right now, yes. That's what's being tested in the clinical trial.
And then there's some confusion over how protective this vaccine would eventually be. Would it look like a vaccine for, like, measles, mumps, rubella, which confers almost lifetime immunity, or would it be something more like a seasonal flu vaccine that you have to get every year that doesn't provide as much protection?
It's a really good question, and we just don't know the answer yet. We won't know until we have the results from the clinical trials. The FDA has set guidelines out for the minimum that it wants a vaccine company to be able to show in order for it to approve a vaccine, and that's 50% efficacy. So that's something that would look much more like a flu vaccine. But I think the reason why they did that was because really, you know, there's a hope and a desire for a vaccine to come out very quickly. And so we really won't know until they get the trial results whether they've exceeded that level or not. And, you know, it could be that it's very effective or it could be that it's not. We just don't know yet.
But if companies are under extraordinary pressure to bring forth a vaccine quickly, wouldn't it make sense that they would settle for something that's not 100% effective, that's just 50% effective?
I think the thinking is that a vaccine with 50 or 60% efficacy would still bring a lot of value to our society and be good news. It doesn't have to be 95% effective.
Yeah. What does efficacy mean? Does that mean like 50% or 60% efficacy does that mean that it confers that to 50 to 60% of the people who take it, or in each person it is 50 to 65% effective?
So the way that they're doing it is the way that the trial works is that half of the people get a placebo dose and then half get the vaccine, and they give them both doses, and then they basically wait and they see who in that trial basically develops COVID-19. And the trial essentially ends when about 150 people develop COVID-19. And then they look and they see how many people in the placebo group developed it and then how many people in the vaccine group developed it. And so that 50% is about that. It's about comparing people who developed COVID-19 and who got a vaccine versus those who are in the placebo group. Obviously, if there's more people and many more people in the placebo group who developed it and not as many people in the vaccine group who did, then we can start to conclude that it's effective.
Mm-hmm. Even if there is a vaccine and even if it is proven to be efficacious and even if they do manage to get it out and distribute it to the states fairly quickly, there's no guarantee people will actually take it. So a lot of people are skeptical. They're skeptical for a lot of reasons. One is there's been a lot of vaccine skepticism to begin with. And secondly, they're skeptical. A lot of people are skeptical that because of the rush in bringing this out, that it might not be a safe drug. So what's going to get people to actually take this drug?
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of hesitancy about this. It's a new virus. Some of the first vaccines are using a vaccine technology that's never been approved in humans before. I think what a lot of people believe is that what is going to make people confident in it is evidence that the companies and the federal government are really following science and, you know, and also that they're being transparent about the results. Recently, a group of 9 vaccine makers who are all kind of in the race for a vaccine, they all signed a pledge that said that they would follow scientific principles and only put forward a vaccine if it was thoroughly vetted for safety and efficacy. The FDA's senior regulators, the directors who actually, you know, make decisions about vaccines and drugs, they also signed an op-ed recently that said that they believed in following the science in any decisions. And so we're seeing some moves by the companies and even regulators really trying to kind of get their message out to the public that this is going to be the same scientific process that will be used to vet this vaccine as has been used in the past.
Katie Thomas covers healthcare and the drug industry for the New York Times. Katie, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, it's been days of bad air because of the wildfires. How should we protect ourselves? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The West Coast's record-setting wildfires have made for days of record-setting hazardous air quality. Communities up and down the coast have seen conditions ranging from unhealthy to literally off the air quality charts. The ash in the sky has forced much of California into an extended smoke advisory, meaning almost all of us should be staying indoors if we can. But after more than a week, it's really tough to flee from bad air quality, and climate scientists say these bad air events will only become more common. With me now to talk about it is Dr. Mary Prunicki. She leads research in air pollution and health at Stanford University. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, we know it's unpleasant, a lot of us, including myself, are coughing. We have, you know, our eyes are watering. But long term, is this having a harmful effect? I hear you're clearing your throat too. Long term, is
just
this having?
Outside.
Wow. So yeah, all of us are having problems. Yeah, with our throats and everything. But what about for the long term?
Well, we could talk about long term, but there are more acute impacts too. Long term, you know, with the wildfire research, we don't know as much. What we do know is based more on occupations that have been continually exposed to the wildfire smoke, such as firefighters. And even in that group, we don't know as much as we should. And it's an area of you know, current research. We know that, you know, short term, obviously we can have the mild symptoms such as that are more annoying, such as the cough or the burning throat or, you know, burning eyes, things like that. But there have been studies that have shown that there can be more severe outcomes from inhaling the smoke, especially in vulnerable populations. And so it's important to keep in mind that, you know, even within an hour of a community experiencing wildfire smoke, you can see an increase in ambulance calls for both respiratory and cardiac distress calls. And we know that there's increases in hospital and ER visits when there's increases in wildfire smoke for various types of outcomes. So both acute and chronically, we know that the smoke is not good for us.
Once you get these fine particulate particles in your lungs that come in the smoke, are they there for good?
Well, some of them stay there and cause irritation, I'm sure, but unfortunately the small ones, so the particulate matter that's 2.5 microns and smaller, so about the width of a human hair, cross over from your lungs into your bloodstream. And from there, they can travel throughout the body and cause problems. So, you know, a lot of these outcomes are associated, have a component of inflammation. And we know that the particulate matter, can, you know, lodge into, you know, areas of your body and stay there. In firefighters, they, have increases in heavy metal exposure, and heavy metals can hop onto particulate matter and kind of ride there as it enters the body. And so that's, you know, one way that we get exposed to some of these kind of nasty toxins.
Can you compare it to, let's say, smoking in terms of what it does to your body?
Sure. We know with smoking, our first line of defense when we breathe in is the cilia that lines our respiratory tract. So the little hair-like projections that beat, and they keep the crud out of our airway. We know that smoking will paralyze those cilia. And so it kind of breaks down the first barrier of protection. Wildfire smoke, you know, is similar. And so that is a problem. And then we also know that, you know, exposure to wildfire smoke can cause changes in the regulation of your immune genes and kind of cause immune dysregulation. And in a similar way, smoke exposure can cause changes in the regulation of your immune genes. and, you know, so there's a lot of correlations between the two.
So that means you'd be less able to fight off a disease like coronavirus.
Exactly. Right. You know, there's been studies that have shown that when a population is exposed to wildfire smoke, their flu season, you know, in the following few months is worse. There's been a lot of predictions that because we're exposed to all this smoke, the COVID rates and severity will go up in our areas. And it makes sense biologically, because we know that, you know, when your immune system takes a hit and then encounters another, pathogen such as a virus, it's less mm-hmm. able to deal with it effectively. Yeah.
So given all that, we should be staying indoors. What else can we do to protect ourselves?
Well, staying indoors obviously is number one. I guess number two, don't assume that your indoor air quality is good. If you have the ability, you know, check your indoor air quality because, you know, older homes, drafty homes, the air quality can be poor. And, you know, if that's the case and you have the ability, you know, use an air purifier or run your air conditioning, create your own air purifier using a box fan and filters. There's you can look on YouTube how to do something like that. If you have to venture outside, wear a mask. Obviously, some masks are better than others. The N95 masks, you know, are reserved for the healthcare community, but the N95 mask with exhalation valves can't be used by healthcare, but they're certainly fine for exposure to the pollution, and they will mm-hmm. filter the particles. Surgical mask, is it going to afford more protection than a cloth mask? But even a cloth mask will afford you some filtering, obviously not ideal, which is why we say that, you know, the best thing to do is stay indoors.
Right. But then there are also people who can't stay indoors, the unhoused, 66,000 or so in LA County alone, who can't
right.
avoid this.
Right. Right.
So there is a proposal to have smoke centers, like cooling centers here in Los Angeles. Do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah, I think it's a terrific idea. You know, it's super unfortunate when people, you know, aren't able to protect their health in that way. And, you know, long term, I think it's a win-win situation for everybody to have a healthier population and to provide opportunities for those that don't have the luxury of being able to, you know, be in clean air to be able to go somewhere like that. I know it's more complicated with the COVID, but if they're able to do so, that's fantastic.
Dr. Mary Prunicki is Director of Air Pollution and Health Research at Stanford University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Big Ten decides to play football. So Governor Gavin Newsom says, what about the Pac-12? We're going to talk about that and the NBA with the Sklar brothers next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Lots happening in the physical world as well as the sports world.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
The Clippers are out of the NBA Western Conference Finals, so no Staples showdown after all. The Lakers will play the Nuggets instead. The Big Ten College Football Conference announced their season is back on. We're going to talk about all this and more with the Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason. Welcome back, you guys.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, okay, Jason, let's begin with the NBA. A lot of fans wanted to see the Lakers play the Clippers. It's not happening.
Yes, not happening. It was a bummer, and I say a bummer not just for L.A., who would have loved to have seen an all-L.A. Western Conference final, but I think in general the NBA thought that those were two of the strongest teams in the NBA this year, and now with Milwaukee out from the East, the number one seed in the East, you know, this was sort of a rehashing of what happened in 2015 to the Clippers. They were up 3-1 in the second round, 3-1, and then in that game five, they had a lead in the game five by 15, 16 points this year against the Nuggets. In 2015 against the Rockets, they were up by 21. They blew the lead. They lost that game. It went to 3-2, then 3-3, and then they eventually lost to the Rockets and lost to the Nuggets. And I think Randy and I were discussing this, and I'll let him talk about this as well, is the notion that in the bubble, you lose home court advantage. And the Clippers would have had Game 7 here at Staples Center had they played the Nuggets outside of the bubble in regular circumstances. And we were talking about what how significant of a loss that was, right, Rand?
Yeah, and Madeline, you think about the emotional lift that a home crowd can give you in that moment when the other team is mounting a comeback, when, you know, you call a timeout and you get your fans behind you. And it is so much of basketball is emotional and it is mental and it is how do you withstand the run of another team? And the Clippers just couldn't do it. And so now you have a Nuggets team that's coming in and facing the Lakers, and the Lakers had better watch out. Because the Nuggets have a center named Nikola Jokic who looks like a guy who hasn't worked out. He looks like an old NBA guy who smokes between quarters. He has that sort of body. He clearly doesn't, but I mean, he is this unbelievable passer. He gets the ball in the right around the free throw line usually, and then you know, defenders have to decide, are we going to collapse on him because he may shoot? And then he can turn. You've got lots of shooters on the outside. And he is just very smart at making the best decision at the last possible minute. And the Lakers, I'm not sure they have an answer for this. So it's going to be a great series.
Okay. And when does it begin?
I believe
tomorrow.
Go ahead, Jim. Yeah, tomorrow. Yeah, I believe tomorrow.
Wow. Okay, cool. All right. Let us move on to football. Big Ten back on. Donald Trump appears to be very excited about this. He tweeted saying, "It is my great honor to have helped." First of all, how did he help?
So he's going to claim that he helped by making a phone call to Big Ten commissioner, to the Big Ten commissioner, Kevin Warren, and putting pressure on him saying that Big Ten needs to come back. Football needs to be back for the Big Ten. Conferences, other Power Five conferences like the SEC and the ACC are coming back. It's a little coincidental, or shall we say not coincidental at all, that some of the states that house Big Ten teams are important swing states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania. So obviously a priority for Donald Trump. He made the call to the Big Ten but didn't make that same call and put that same pressure on the Pac-12, which are mostly states that he's anticipating losing anyway. So it was a political move. I think the real reason why the Big Ten is done an about-face since postponing or canceling their fall season on August 11th is because there are now rapid tests that are reliable and available where you can test everyone every single day, including day of the game. And their attitude was, look, if we can guarantee that every single person stepping on that field and being in the field of play that day is COVID-free, and obviously there might be a false test, but in general, if we can say 99% that everybody's COVID-free, then we feel better about our chances of just letting people play and having football. And once they got that guarantee that they would get enough tests and once they knew that they were going to be able to play in their minds safely, then they could commit to playing football this fall. So it had less to do with Trump and more to do with sort of new knowledge and medical advancements.
And Madeline, I will say this, that they also are, you know, the Big Ten is not just putting it on the schools to police their situation. They've basically created like a, I can only call it like code and a color. So if for the city that the school is in as well. So Michigan's in Ann Arbor. If Ann Arbor as a city is in the green or orange range, and the team is in the green or orange range, you can play the game. But then if both the city and the team are sort of in a hot spot, they're both red, then your team cannot play. Even if you could field a team of players and coaches, you cannot play if your city is in that sort of red range. And I think that extra thought that the Big Ten put into that has assuaged a lot of fear from some of the presidents.
But still, there will be people in the stands, right?
I mean, no, they're saying no people in the stands. Okay. That's what the Big Ten has decided. You know, in other schools, we've seen different variations. We've seen, you know, a few thousand people in a 100,000-seat stadium. We've also seen just parents of the kids, of the players themselves, parents and families. So the Big Ten is saying no fans right now. Now, that may change, but that, again, speaks to how they're being hypersensitive to safety. And part of the reason why they decided to start the season as early as October 24th is they'll be able to get an 8-game season with a 9th game, which would be a conference championship game, on December 19th, the day before they decide the college playoff who will be the four teams that will make the college playoff on December 20th. And that's super important because the Big Ten not only will be playing for their own conference championship, but now they can participate in the national stage, which is important for teams like Ohio State, and I'll throw Michigan in there as well, and Penn State, teams that really do feel like they have a shot to make that national playoff, which is does wonders for a team in terms of recruiting, in terms of moving forward, in terms of the conference itself. The Big Ten wants to be represented in the national playoff with those three other teams.
Mm-hmm. So far the Pac-12 is not playing, but Governor Newsom seemed to hold open the door a little bit.
Yeah, Governor Newsom said it's, you know, and the Big Ten is kind of showing the way. I think the Pac-12 is seeing how the Big Ten is doing it, and they're laying the groundwork for how a Pac-12 season could exist. And, you know, USC has a really good team. Oregon has a really good team and has recruited really well. So, you know, those are two teams that are in the national championship conversation, Oregon more than USC. But the Pac-12, I think, would stand to follow the Big Ten's lead here to try and play and at least get it in. Look, you're looking at Major League Baseball, which didn't really bubble up there. You're playing in specific stadiums in different cities, and it's not like the NBA where they all went to Orlando, or the NHL where the Eastern Conference went to Toronto and the Western Conference went to Edmonton. You're playing in your hometown, so it's a lot scarier, and you have a lot more opportunities mm-hmm. for people to get COVID.
Yeah.
I do think that there's a chance to get done.
We have 1 minute left, and I just want to ask you this. It seems like golf is maybe the perfect coronavirus sport, and the U.S. Open starts today, right?
Yes, starts today. It's already started. Golf is amazing, and if you watch golf on TV, then maybe you need to get a life. Kidding. I watch it. I enjoy it. But I will say this. Golf is one of the sports that looks the most like it did before coronavirus. You're missing the galleries, yes. But with the way they're filming golf, it's just as exciting, and they've had a really exciting season so far. So there's a strong field coming into the U.S. Open. They're saying Wingfoot is going to be one of the toughest courses ever. They think someone will be above par. That's how hard they think this course is going to play. Yeah. So it's going to be an exciting weekend.
Ran, you've got 5 seconds.
And the way they made it more difficult was because guys are hitting the ball farther. So they have to put pin placement and hazards and make it more difficult, and that's what they did.
Okay. Golf it is. Randy and Jason Sklar, the Sklar brothers. Check out their sports podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, searching for alien life, why many scientists think we should. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Astronomers announced this week that they found a possible sign of life in the inhospitable atmosphere of Venus. Traces of phosphine, a gas that microorganisms here on Earth make. Scientists aren't saying they found alien life in the clouds of Venus just yet, but the news of the gas discovery had the astronomy community and space watchers very excited. Why is it that so many humans so badly want there to be alien life out there? What's behind our fascination with ETs, with UFOs? Journalist Laura Krantz became kind of obsessed herself with these questions after finding out about a mysterious interstellar visitor to our solar system, spotted in the sky over Hawaii. In her podcast, Wild Thing, Laura Krantz explores humans' quest for the unknown. In the first season, it was Bigfoot, and now in season 2, Wild Thing, Space Invaders. She looks to the skies. Laura Krantz, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be back.
It's nice to have you explore these questions, because it's questions, obviously, we're obsessed with, and we make tons of movies about it. E.T., Space Odyssey, Independence Day, and on and on and on. Of course, we've got science fiction books, you know, wondering if there's life out there. And I think many of us wonder that when we just look up into the sky. And so was that basically what started you on your quest, that you yourself were wondering, hey, are we alone?
Yeah, I think it was a question that was kind of in the back of my head. But then this interstellar object that came into our view, per se, I mean, we had to use telescopes, we couldn't see it with the naked eye. But that happened in October of 2017, and then I was followed closely on the heels by the reports of a secret Pentagon UFO program. And what was interesting to me was just how much both of those stories blew up. Like, everybody was talking about them. They were all over the internet. They were all over major newspapers. They were in science journals. So there's all these conversations going on, and people are clearly fascinated by this topic. And I kind of was coming off the heels of the Bigfoot exploration and wondering why people were fascinated by that. But this one seemed to me an even bigger, astronomically larger, you could say, topic. And it's really interesting because it's not necessarily a question that we'll be able to get an answer to, at least in our lifetime.
Why don't you think? You really don't think we'll get an answer?
I think we might have an answer on microbial life. And in fact, if there is microbial life in our solar system, I think we will definitely get an answer about that one. In fact, I might even be willing to put money down that they're going to find it on Venus or Mars. I just think that it's based on what I've heard and all of the information that just came out this week about Venus and what I know about the Perseverance mission that is now headed to Mars. I think there's a really good chance. But when it comes to like intelligent extraterrestrial life that we're going to like shake hands with and have a treaty with, or who are going to teach us things and give us technology, I don't think that's going to happen in our lifetime, and maybe not ever, because something like that is probably so far away in terms of time and distance that it just doesn't seem that likely.
So does it seem likely, though, amongst the scientific community that there is something out there? Is there a unanimous feeling amongst researchers who study this for a living that, hey, there is a strong possibility that there's life out there?
I think almost everybody I talk to, be it SETI scientists who are really doing search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or astrobiologists who are looking more at the precursors for life and the chemical and biochemical origins of life, everybody just had this feeling that there's something out there. We don't have the concrete proof. We don't have the evidence that would rise to the level of scientific scrutiny. But I think most people are really pretty certain that there's something else out there.
Let's hear from Harvard astronomer Avi Loeb and what he has to say about this.
I don't think that we are special or unique. I think it's a sign of arrogance on our behalf to think that we are special. And I think it's a purely scientific program to check for the existence of alien civilizations out there, because we exist.
Let's talk specifically about this discovery in Hawaii in 2017. What did scientists observe in the skies there?
So what really happened was there were a series of photographs that were coming in from the telescopes that they have on the top of one of the Hawaiian islands. And I think scientists didn't really catch this until sort of last minute when they saw this very fast-moving object, which they could chart because subsequent photographs gave you a sense of how fast it was moving and how bright it was. And they realized that the trajectory of this thing showed that it was coming from outside our solar system, that it was likely an interstellar object. And then the question became, all right, what exactly is it? Is it a comet? But they couldn't see what's called a cometary tail, which is sort of the dust and the gas and the little bits of rock that are coming off from behind a comet that you normally might see. And it also wasn't moving the same way they had thought of comets as moving. Every time they sort of plotted a course for it, it would just veer off that course ever so slightly. So it was a little tough to predict. So that raised some questions as to what actually it might be. And one of the hypotheses that was put forward was by a guy named Avi Loeb, who we just heard from. And he is an astronomer at Harvard. And he suggested that maybe, just maybe, this might be an alien light sail. Now, he is working on light sail technology here on Earth, so he probably is thinking along those lines anyway. But I think his bigger point was that we really ought to be considering the idea of intelligent extraterrestrial life as a possibility as well. And he didn't come right out and say that, yes, this is definitely an alien light sail. This is proof that ET is out there. But I think what he wants is to have scientists think about the possibilities and open their minds to more than just sort of the standard natural occurrences that seem to be the most obvious choices.
Right. But there are skeptics who think, well, yeah, maybe it's an outside chance, but the likelihood is vanishingly small, right?
Right. I mean, you know, his was one hypothesis that was put forward. It caught everybody's attention because, I mean, who doesn't want to imagine that aliens are out there? But it has also been raised that, you know, as you go down the list of things that it could be, aliens is probably pretty close to the bottom of that list. And it's much more likely to be something that we can explain based on the knowledge we already have of the solar system and of the galaxy. So, and in part, it's an exercise in imagination and creativity and thinking a little bit differently. But we also have to sort of consider the real probabilities.
But you did go to Roswell, right?
I did go to Roswell.
Ground zero for people who believe in UFOs.
Yes.
And what do people tell you? What do regular people tell you about it?
You know, most of the people I spoke to in Roswell think that something crashed in the desert in 1947 and the government is covering it up. What that is, nobody really seems to know. And there are a lot of conflicting opinions about what it is, where it came from, where it actually crashed. Were there little green men or little gray men inside? I heard stories of bodies that were then squirreled away to Area 51. So there's all kinds of conspiracy theories that surround this. But Roswell, I think, is interesting because something did happen there. And I don't think there is any question that there was a crash that left the desert littered with little bits and pieces of wood and other materials from whatever this craft was. The government line is that it was a weather balloon. And then the government line 50 years later was it was actually part of a top secret project to keep an eye on the Soviets, which if you think about where Roswell is in the middle of the desert and what Roswell is home to, which is the Army airfield where the 509 bombing division came out of. And this is the 509th were the planes that dropped the bomb on Japan. You know, there was a lot of concern about nuclear, and this was kind of a hub for that sort of information and that stuff that they were doing. So it makes sense. I mean, there's a lot of little pieces here that make sense when you think about it in the larger context of the time and what was happening. But it also, you know, it gets to the fact that people don't necessarily trust the government and the government's information, especially when the government clearly changed the story 50 years later. And has also not always been forthcoming about operations that it's doing in that region. You know, they set off those atomic bombs, the test ones in the 40s, and didn't really give anybody much notice or warning, and certainly didn't warn the citizens of the area. So you can see why there's a little bit of disenchantment with the government line.
Yeah, and on top of the fact that the government has funded studies and investigations into UFOs.
Yes. So this came out in 2017, roughly around the same time that the story about Oumuamua came out, which is that interstellar object. And they basically had there was all these newspaper stories saying that the government had run or the Pentagon had run a secret UFO program between 2007 and 2012. And the thing I think that's important to remember here is when the military is talking about UFOs, they're not necessarily talking about aliens. They are taking a very literal definition here, which is unidentified flying object. So again, it makes sense that the government would have a program like that, because if there's weird stuff flying around in your airspace where you're running military operations, you're going to want to know what it is. They're not saying it's aliens. There are people in the military who were formerly in the military who do think it could be aliens. But this kind of goes back to the other point where until you have the kind of solid proof that's going to verify that, you kind of have to go with the most obvious solution.
Did you come to any differing conclusion after having done all your research? Were you skeptical originally and now you're less so, or vice versa, or what?
I think it's kind of a mix. So with the UFO program with the Pentagon, I'm probably one of those people, like the majority of people in America, who sort of equate UFOs with aliens. I think that's just been tabloid fodder for so long that we kind of those are synonymous in our minds. And this kind of clarified that for me. When the Pentagon says they're running a UFO program, it's very different than, say, you know, the ufologists in Roswell running a UFO program. Like, it's kind of a different cultural definition. So that kind of helped me understand the context in which that program was being run. I think, too, You know, I hadn't really spent a lot of time thinking about extraterrestrial life. Like, it was the sort of thing that you'd might be, oh, yeah, there's probably something out there. And when I realized what kind of work we're doing and the kind of, like, research and time and the technology we have to go out and look for extraterrestrial life, be it single-celled or big-brained, it's pretty exciting. You know, if they do prove that there is life in Venus's atmosphere, or they're able to find proof of life on Mars, what that says is if there's multiple examples of life in our solar system, chances are there is life all over the galaxy, which is amazing to think about.
Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been great.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear the entire season. Laura Krantz is host of the Wild Thing podcast, Season 2, Space Invaders, launches today. Laura, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, that does it for us today. Thanks so much for listening. Wherever you are, you might be really far away. You might be out there. Stay safe. Be well. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.